Welcome to a series of netcasts brought to you by Yale University.
The following panel discussion, titled Climate Change in the Courts, features Yale Law School professor Douglas Kaiser, Benjamin Ewing, New York University School of Law professor Richard Epstein, and Berkeley Law professor Daniel Farber, who debate the role of courts in responding to global warming.
This is the panel called Climate Change in the Courts. That's what it was billed as on the posters that you may have seen around. Actually, the panel comes out of an article that the Yale Law Journal published earlier this year by two of our panelists, Professor Kaiser and Ben Ewing. And the article is called Prods and Pleas, Limited Government in an Era of Unlimited Harm. So if you came here today to learn about recent climate change litigation strategy or doctrine, you will get some of that. But really, the discussion today will also focus on some other things. To paraphrase Kaiser and Ewing loosely, the discussion will focus not only on what courts can or cannot do about climate change, but also on what climate change litigation can teach us about the institutional dynamics of the separation of powers and about common law tort adjudication in the modern era. We're excited to be joined today not only by both of the authors of the article, but also by two incredibly distinguished scholars, both of whom have written and published essays in response to this article on YLJ Online. So we have Professor Richard Epstein, who is a professor of law at New York University Law School and the University of Chicago. And his essay, Beware of Prods and Pleas, is up on the Yale Law Journal online. If you haven't seen it, I recommend that you check it out after the panel. And then on my far left, we have Professor Daniel Farber, who is professor of law at University of California Berkeley School of Law, whose essay, Preventing Policy Default, is, I think, either up or imminently will be up on the ARPIT, imminent, 1 week? ARPIT. It'll be up in 1 week on the Yale Law Journal online. So check that out. And then, of course, on the end, we have Ben Ewing, who is a doctoral student in the Department of Politics at Princeton and a recent graduate of Yale Law School, and Professor Doug Kaiser. And their article was the impetus for this session today. Before we begin, just another word quickly about the format. Ben and Professor Kaiser will begin the discussion with about 10 to 15 minutes on their article. And then Professor Epstein and Farber will each have 10 minutes to respond, in that order, I believe, unless you prefer a different way. And then we'll loop around to give everyone a chance to react, and then we'll turn to questions from you all. And finally, this event was put on, I have to acknowledge, by the Yale Law Journal, by a few other organizations, the American Constitution Society, by the Federalist Society, and by the Yale Environmental Law Association. And special thanks to Madhuri, if she's out there, for organizing a lot of the logistics for this panel. So with that, I'll turn it over to Ben.
Great, thank you, Alex. Doug and I have decided to break up our discussion in terms of, on the one hand, prods and pleas as a general idea in our constitutional order, and on the other hand, prods and pleas as applied specifically to the context of climate change and climate change tort litigation. So I'm going to start by talking about some general qualities of prods and pleas that will be important to bear in mind. To start with something with which we're all familiar, the separation of powers, as we all know, is an important aspect of our constitutional system, as is federalism. We have division of tasks and authority to different actors in government, and this is often thought to be an important requisite for the rule of law. Many people think that if you put the tasks of creating law and interpreting law and applying it in the same office or office holder, that it looks like you have something like rule by men rather than the rule of law. So separation of powers and also federalism are very important, but the division of authority in our system is not pure or clean. Rather, it involves overlapping edges and principle that we're all familiar with of checks and balances. But precisely because of the overlapping spheres of authority and the checks on political action, which we see in things like the bicameral legislature, the veto power, the difficulty of constitutional amendment, all these structural checks that make collective political action through our system of government difficult, we also see that when social and political movements develop, they get channeled through all the different government actors and all the different branches, not necessarily just through the traditional route of legislation. And in turn, we see that when pressure gets put on actors such as courts, they exert pressure on other branches, and the process is not just one that has the direction of stymieing activity, but also can be one of what Doug and I have termed prods and pleas as a kind of analog or inversion of classical checks and balances which seek to limit government activity. Now, there are five things that I want to say about prods and pleas by way of introduction that hopefully will forestall some concerns and potential objections. So the first thing to say is that prods and pleas, like checks and balances, do not have one single easy universal political valence in a contemporary partisan sense. Although it's true that checks and balances might well be associated with a kind of Burkean incrementalism, and prods and pleas might be associated with something more along the lines of Roberto Unger's idea of a quickening of politics. Prods and pleas can be marshaled by conservatives and liberals alike. So we're going to talk about climate change tort suits today, but we could equally talk about the way that, say, Arizona has taken on the national issue of illegal immigration with SB 1070. Second thing I want to say about prods and pleas is that they will vary considerably in their instrumental efficacy. We can have both prods and pleas. We can have firm things, such as when the Supreme Court rules that California is violating the Eighth Amendment due to its prison overcrowding and it needs to reduce within several years the extent of the overcrowding. Or we can have pleas, such as when President Obama calls out the Supreme Court for its decision in Citizens United. But we can also observe that sometimes prods and pleas will backfire and will not have the political consequences that people who would invoke them would hope that they would have. An example of this might be the handgun litigation context, in which immunization of gun manufacturers from certain kinds of liability is arguably contrary to what people who would have liked to have been using the courts to prod and plead with the legislature to address handgun regulation would have liked. Okay, a third point is that in addition to the instrumental lever or tool idea of prods and pleas, there's also a sense that prods and pleas can entail a kind of normative conversation that has intrinsic value, so to speak. We'll talk a little bit about this in the context of climate change tort suits and the idea that by engaging the substantive norms of the body of law of tort, irrespective of the tangible shifts in the political winds or the kind of obvious brute consequences of climate change tort suits, we can hopefully get a richer normative conversation going that engages contemporary questions in the light of long-standing traditional values that are manifested in the private law of tort. Okay, the fourth thing to say is that prods and pleas is both descriptive and prescriptive. We see prods and pleas as an idea that captures a certain dynamic that already exists in our system, but we also see it as a kind of ethos that could be embraced much more self-consciously than it is today by government actors in order to sort of quicken politics in a way that we think would be desirable for a variety of reasons. I guess the last thing then to say is, well, part of our thesis is that prods and pleas are distinctively valuable today in what Doug has very helpfully, I think, termed an era of unlimited harm. And just to kind of sketch a little bit of sense of why we think that this is so, and also to get a better sense of how prods and pleas fit into our constitutional order and can be understood as really faithful to the ideals of our constitutional order rather than subversive of them, I think it's important to think about this idea that the founders had that we really should be trying to prevent against the aggregation of power and its potentially tyrannical effects. But we need to think about that in light of the fact that today this old idea of a kind of Hobbesian Leviathan, which is embodied by the government, is really no longer a useful heuristic for thinking about the distribution and the flows of power in our society. If we look at contemporary problems like climate change or like global finance, if we think about corporate bailouts or we think about super PAC money run amok, we see that there are many different ways in which we can be harmed by private actors who have amassed astonishing amounts of power that flows in very complex, interconnected ways. And if we want to try to check that in a very sort of classical liberal way, we're going to have to think about different sort of institutional mechanisms, not always just restraining government, but also sometimes really pushing it to action. And I guess with that, I'll turn it over to Doug.
Great, thanks, Ben. While I've got the floor, let me just first say thanks to YLJ for putting on this event. It's a real privilege to have Professors Epstein and Farber commenting on the piece. Thanks also to Alex for being an incredible editor on the piece. The main case study in the piece of Prods and Pleas is climate change nuisance litigation. That's given rise to a lot of confusion about what our aim was in the project. So let me stress that we were not trying to offer a kind of argument about what the ideal policy solution to climate change would be. We're not engaging in a debate about the choice between taxes or cap and trade or command and control regulation. We're not engaged in a debate about which ideal institution should respond to the climate change problem, Congress, courts, agencies, state and local. We're not engaging in those kinds of debates. Those debates have been going on for the better part of 25 years. They'll continue to go on, I'm sure. But I think, and I'm speaking mainly for myself here, I don't want to ascribe this to Ben, but I think there's a naive positivism about the way much of the climate change policy literature proceeds. It seems to assume that we have a very well-behaved political system. It seems to assume that scientists will be able to objectively convey the details and the severity of the problem, that lawyers and economists and engineers will then be able to provide enlightened advice about how to address the problem, that the public properly informed will then ask their faithful representatives to address the problem. They will do so by delegating authority to responsible bureaucrats in the agencies, and then the regulated community will comply. That, to me, is a naively positivistic view of the way our system works. And it's akin to what Pierre Schlag, the great theorist at University of Colorado, calls air law. By air law, he does not mean the law of air pollution. He means air law like air guitar. It's scholars writing as if there is a guitar in their hands, as if there is a well-behaved political system out there that's just waiting to consume their policy advice and then output the policy response. We don't, I believe, have that well-behaved political system, and so we have to be mindful of indulging in air law. We also probably don't necessarily have a system that is inherently progressive in the way we would like to believe. We tend to think that our systems are steadily evolving in the direction of moral and intellectual progress. So we'd like to believe that the Arab Spring would have happened irrespective of whether a shopkeeper in Tunisia set himself on fire. We'd like to believe that abolition would have happened irrespective of whether Lord Mansfield issued his opinion in Somerset's case. We'd like to believe that Jeremy Lin's talents would have been recognized irrespective of whether his teammate got injured. We'd like to believe those things, but it's quite possible that within these complex adaptive systems, a different equilibrium altogether would have ensued. And that's a very unsettling thought, both because it disrupts our top-down managerial fantasy about how it is that we achieve progress, and also because it suggests that we don't necessarily know where the catalysts within the systems are going to come, even if we do eventually achieve our aims. So what we're trying to do in the paper is to avoid both the naive positivism of Erlaw and the naive optimism of progressive thought. We wanted to think very concretely and very soberly about where within our framework of limited government we might find pressure points, potential levers, potential catalytic actors. And we focused on tort law as our main case for a number of reasons. Most immediately, there was very salient and important climate change nuisance litigation winding its way through the federal courts toward the Supreme Court. And we knew that the argumentation in that case was going to present to the Supreme Court important doctrinal issues about standing and political question doctrine that had the court embraced those ways of dismissing the case, we think it would have been a very pernicious outcome that would have had effects not just for environmental tort litigation, but for a whole wide array of tort lawsuits. We also focused on tort because we are sort of tort classicist. We see tort not in a Calabresian or Posnerian way as an implicit regulatory institution, which just invites thought about comparative institutional competence, and tort then immediately looks like a blunt and crude instrument for trying to address something like the climate change problem. We don't think about tort that way. We think of tort as a classical liberal system in which individuals bring their private grievances to a neutral arbiter. It's a locus, a residual locus for the airing of grievances within a system where the other bodies, the other branches, are not always responsive, and in fact are sort of constructed in a way that they can't be responsive. They're deliberately sort of hobbled. And so you're left with tort law as this residual place to go. And we think that applies not only to individuals, but also in a certain sense to states. When a state is feeling aggrieved within the federal system, it historically could invoke the original jurisdiction of the federal courts. And assert itself in a dignified, self-possessed way, not as an object of beneficent regulation from on high, from Congress, but instead as an actor with dignity and rights, asserting them against its sister states. So that classical private law understanding of tort is, we think, important. We think it's the best explanation of tort within itself, but also the best explanation of tort as it resides in this complex system of limited government. That part of the reason why limited government can sustain itself is that tort remains as a pressure valve in the system, a place where folks can go or states can go and demand a reasoned response to a grievance that's not being addressed elsewhere. And so we think, in that sense, it's a quintessential locus for prods and pleas.
Professor, oh, yes, thank you. I'm going to talk about climate change and talk about it in relationship to the way in which the classical liberal systems, which Doug referred, actually works. And I think I see John is here, Langbein, and I'm going to start with some legal history about how it is that a successful system of integration has taken place with private actions on the one hand and with public enforcement on the other. And I refer to an anonymous decision from 1536, which deals with the coordination of private rights of actions on public roads with the actions of an administrative body. And essentially, the scheme that they adopted in this particular case was as follows. With respect to sort of low-level, high diffuse harm suffered by large numbers of individuals, the appropriate remedy would only be administrative. And what would happen is that the person, for example, who blocked the highway or dug the hole would be subject to a fine, and the state would come in and patch the hole or remove the obstacle so that traffic could continue. And the theory is, if you try to put together private rights of actions for these small, diffuse harms, there's no mechanism which is going to be as effective as the simple, direct remedy. And you're willing to give up on compensation because the administrative remedy will give you prompt relief on the one hand and deterrence on the other hand for things taking place. But it turns out that when you have various kinds of injuries or obstacles of that sort, you can have people who suffer disproportionate harm. And the disproportionate harm, for example, would come if somebody happens to run into the pothole or the obstacle, break an axle or a shoulder or something of the sort. And the rule is that if you have one of these large harms that are above and beyond the background risk associated with everybody else, i.e. the inconvenience or delay of having a longer trip, you're entitled to bring a private right of action because now the deterrence from a single party is going to be effective. You're within the framework of the Aristotelian unities where tort actions actually kind of work. Single moment, single plaintiff, single defendant, easy proofs on causation and contributory negligence and the like. And in effect, the system could work. And so the great question that they worried about in 1535 is whether or not when there was a public nuisance that blocked somebody's access from his private land, would this be analogized to the ordinary loss of delay, or would it be analogized to the broken bones? And they decided, I think correctly, that it would be the latter. So what you do here is you have a kind of coordination between different kinds of systems, administrative and adjudicative. On the one hand, you have it within the framework of the English government so that you don't have to worry about federalism or those kinds of complications, and you don't have to worry about the kinds of separation of powers issues at the federal level that we have in the United States. The question then is, how does this particular insight on the distribution of private and public wrongs carry over when you deal with the question of government, of global warming? And the first thing that you have to realize is that it's not all that easy to figure out, is there a harm, and if so, what is its extent? I'm not going to get into the debate about global warming and how serious and imminent the threat it turns out to be, but whatever the answer to that question, it is not nearly as apparent as it is in the case when the highway has been disrupted. And so before you could have any kind of overall strategy as to what it is you're supposed to do about it, somebody's going to have to make a kind of an estimate as to what the severity of the harm is. In addition to that, it turns out that when you're dealing with global warming, whatever happens in the United States can be offset by whatever happens anywhere else in the world. That if you take the simplest model of carbon dioxide, it doesn't matter where it is emitted. If it goes up into the atmosphere, it does the same amount of harm regardless of its source. And so one of the things you have to worry about, and I think it's probably the most important thing you worry about, is we are essentially fiddling around with deck chairs on the Titanic, given the huge increases of carbon dioxide emissions that take place from China and India, who are not subject to any of our internal types of control. And you're going to have to work through the political economy question. And there's no way that you can do that in any way, shape, or form through a judicial system. So then the next question is, suppose you have worked that way through, what are you going to try to do in the domestic? If you go back and you look at the older analogies, what you typically discover is that there is no particular kind of special injury that any given citizen or firm suffers from global warming relative to anybody else. In other words, to go back to my public nuisance example, this is a case where you got lots of people with inconvenience and delay. You don't have anybody with a broken shoulder or loss of access. What this suggests is, in fact, that the tort remedy is going to be peculiarly ill-suited to deal with these particular cases because you have such prosaic difficulties of figuring out who ought to be a plaintiff and who ought to be a defendant and what ought to be the forum in which these things are going to be resolved. And so going back to the older view, the correct view as a matter of first principle is we love tort systems for all sorts of reasons, but this is not going to be the kind of system that is going to work, and so that we should be very careful about the effect of introducing a system which could create mischief on the one hand, but can't create any kind of informed judgment on the other. This becomes particularly apparent if one starts to ask the question, what kinds of remedies are you going to give? The damages are simply not there in quantitative fashion. And then on the second part of this particular situation, it also turns out that injunctive relief runs into very serious difficulties because you don't have a unitary jurisdiction over which these activities will take place. All this stuff is going on everywhere at every given time. So then what should you do? Well, it seems to me that the only thing left for you to do is to start to engage in some kind of a legislative activities which ask the very self-conscious question, how much of this stuff do we want to reduce, and how can we target the kinds of individuals or institutions that ought to be targeted or ought to be made to answer for the kinds of things that happen? And at this particular point, the question should really turn into a discussion of how it is that we organize a sort of environmental effort. And I'm just going to start with the assumption that there is something domestically that can be done about the carbon dioxide thing and ask about the question of what the form ought to be. Now, one of the great disasters in American law with respect to this issue has, I think, been the decision in the Massachusetts versus EPA case, where they decided that carbon dioxide was a pollutant with respect to the air control acts that we've had under this place, not because I don't think there's a problem associated with carbon dioxide, but because the system that was designed to deal with sulfur dioxide and a variety of other kinds of common pollutants simply does not work very well when you're trying to apply it with respect to carbon dioxide. The American statutes on air control all feature a very elaborate extent of federal and state cooperation. Federal government sets ambient air standard qualities. States come up with an implementation plan. The feds don't like that plan, then they have a federal implementation plan that could override the state implementation plan, or the SIPs against the FIPS, as it's called, for those people who do environmental law. And when you're dealing with carbon dioxide with its global implications, there's no need whatsoever to have these kinds of local intrusions into the situation. They're only going to make things further. So that's one clear structural error. The second one is, if you go back and you look at the major compromises under our statutes, what they decided to do, wrongly as it turns out, was to let time take care of the problem of improved technology and obsolescent plants. So the way the statute has worked, all existing plans are to some extent grandfathered, and that all of the new restrictions, whether you're talking about stationary subjects on the one hand or about the kind of vehicle movements on the other, ought to be applied to new vehicles. This is absolutely crazy as a matter of good environmental design. First point about it is that the new stuff is always better than the old stuff, even if you're not aiming for pollution, just the efficiency of production will necessarily limit what's going on. So what you'd like to do is to move the shift as rapidly as you can. And what the current program does is it essentially grandfathers inefficient sources to very low levels of regulatory review and subjects new sources to extremely high standards of review, which means, in effect, that all the action takes place by people who try to patch together old plants to make them comply with whatever interim standards exist and delays the introduction of the new plants in question. So what you have to do is to understand that the major impediments that we have to a rational plan in this point is that we've taken a faulty design on air pollution control from the 1970s and have tried to carry it forward into this particular situation. So what does this then suggest about the overall way in which we look at this stuff? It suggests to me that prods and pleas are decidedly a second-order type consideration as opposed to the question of proper institutional design. If you could get people on board as to understand why this thing should be done in a particular fashion, the one I've indicated, then you can figure out exactly what kind of empirical work you're going to have to know in order to figure out what the overall size of the threat is. And then the coordination is going to be between domestic efforts on the one hand and international efforts on the other hand, where again the question of environmental design turns out to be exactly paramount. So I think there's an important lesson to learn here. I don't believe that anybody can do modern planning unless they understand a series of rather traditional institutional arrangements. And I started off life as a legal historian in some degree. I'm never a professional one, but, you know, amateur. And what always strikes me about this is if you know your kind of fundamental tort stuff and you realize that the classical liberal tort system is much more complicated than the description you just heard, then, in effect, you will decide, in effect, to back off of modern gimmicks and see if you could figure out how traditional principles will apply to these very difficult areas. Thank you.
Professor Farber.
I wish that they had allocated time by number of words rather than by minutes. I feel a little handicapped in following Richard. It's delightful to be here today. And I think the areas of agreement or partial agreement between those of us here are probably as significant in some ways as the areas of disagreement. So I want to start with those and then talk a little about areas of disagreement. One thing I think is very important, probably the most important thing, is that everyone at the table seems to agree that we need some kind of federal regulatory scheme to deal with climate change. If I'm correct about that, I wish that Richard would call some of his friends in the Republican Party.
And I have no friends.
In any event, I think that's, given the state of American politics, I think that's a very important point.
And they have no friends in the Republican,
Party, that too. That too.
Democrat.
Second, I agree with much of the framework of the Ewing and Kaiser paper about the division of authority, about the difficulties that we're now encountering with the normal channels for making policy, in particular with Congress, which seems to be have turned into a logjam, and you know, as somebody said, a place where good regulations go to die. But I'll come later to some of the things that at least I would have emphasized differently in the paper. One of the areas where I think I disagree with the other speakers, but I won't dwell on it, is about the nature of tort law. At least from what I see in having taught torts a few times, but by no means being a scholar, it seems to me that in fact the tort law has two somewhat conflicting faces. One oriented toward protection of rights in a kind of liberal scheme, but the other very much public policy oriented. And sometimes these coincide, sometimes there's tension between them. I guess I'm not going, I also agree with Richard about the relative lack of utility for public nuisance law in addressing climate change. I think that there are an awful lot of barriers to successfully winning a nuisance case based on existing legal doctrine. The one place I think I disagree is about the lack of specific harm. If climate change were just a matter of raising the temperature of the air, I think he would be right, but other effects are much more specific. Villages in Alaska that will disappear under the water have an individualized harm that's not shared by everyone. That's sort of a side point, but I did want to address that. Let me move to some of the areas that I discuss in my comment on the paper. The subtitle of my comment is something like Stopgaps and Fallbacks in the Administrative State. And that subtitle is intended to signal some difference about emphasis with the authors of the paper. One about the paper's emphasis on tort law and private law in general, and the other about the paper's emphasis on the effect of actions on other government actors as opposed to their actual policy impact. I don't think there's anything in the article that is really inconsistent with what I'm saying, but the article focuses on things that, in my view, are less central to the phenomena that we're talking about here. So let me begin with the emphasis on private law. Law schools notoriously stress private law in the first year, and law professors often stress constitutional law when they're thinking about public law. But the reality is that we live in an administrative state where administrative agencies are involved in dealing with most important social problems, far more so than constitutional courts or private law courts, and also one where the judicial function is at least as important in policing the work of administrative agencies and interpreting statutes as it is in constitutional law or private law. I would like to at least sort of push the balance back in the opposite direction in terms of thinking about prods and pleas. It seems to me that in terms of litigation, Massachusetts versus EPA, which is apart from the standing discussion, entirely a case about statutory interpretation and administrative law. It seems to me that case is far more important than the nuisance litigation could ever have been. It's an important case for several reasons. One is that it establishes, and this is, I guess, the constitutional side of the case, it establishes that climate change can give rise to standing. And that's important in terms of the future administration of whatever the federal government does end up doing. It's also important in terms of other forms of litigation, such as challenges to a variety of other federal agency actions under statutes such as NEPA. So that standing holding is important. I think we all agree that the court was correct about standing in Massachusetts versus EPA and correct to affirm the standing ruling in American Electric Power, although we have probably somewhat different theories of standing behind that. The statutory interpretation ruling is also important in practical terms because it required EPA to start a rulemaking about whether climate change endangers human health and welfare, and if so, what EPA should do about it. Now, that rulemaking itself is a forum for the kind of public input that Kaiser and Ewing talk about in their paper. And I agree, I think, certainly Richard has said it, I think everyone would agree that the existing Clean Air Act is an awkward vehicle for dealing with climate change. However, it turns out not to be a completely useless vehicle. The portion of the act that everyone is familiar with, or at least you're familiar with if you know anything much about environmental law, are these state and federal implementation plans. But it turns out that EPA has found other provisions of the statute that are more readily adaptable to the climate change issue. There are problems with those too that are now in litigation, but I think they have at least some prospect for making, according to sort of neutral analysts like Resources for the Future, having a significant impact on climate. So I won't pursue that part of the discussion any further because I want to turn to my final point, which is that the paper focuses on kind of the process benefits of prods and pleas, but I think it's also very important because the redundancies and overlap and conflicts within our governance system also create the opportunity for people to get things actually done, not just for people to send wake-up calls to other government actors. And in fact, in the climate change area, state governments, led by California, but also joined by northeastern states and a variety of other states, have taken very significant action on climate change. Action that I think is much more significant than the public nuisance litigation could have produced. I think that that action is constructive for a variety of reasons, one of which is that it provides an opportunity for experimenting with regulatory tools that can later be used by Congress, but also for a variety of reasons that are too complicated to discuss right now. I think that the direct effect of these actions in reducing carbon actually is significant and is not necessarily drowned out by actions elsewhere in the world. All of that is not to say that we really need federal action and we really need international agreement to come to grips with the problem, only to say that in the interim, state action and EPA action may be useful. So bottom line is, although I agree with everything in the paper, I think that there are other aspects of the same phenomenon that deserve a good deal more attention. And so I view my comment on the paper as kind of a useful coda, building on the paper to address some related issues. Thanks.
Okay, we're going to send it back around for another round of responses here, beginning with Professor Kaiser and or Ben.
Okay, I just stress that we We certainly don't think that the common law in the 16th century would have cognized climate change as an actionable, remediable harm. And we even don't think that 21st century tort law would probably, if I were a betting person, I would say it would not recognize greenhouse gas emissions as an actionable act. And in fact, I've written a separate article that details about 20 different doctrinal ways in which we think the plaintiffs will lose on the merits in these cases. But we think it's quite important that they be given the opportunity to lose on the merits. And this is where the kind of signaling and normative development aspects of the prods and pleas concept come in. When we think about the way the common law failed to adapt to the industrial carnage that characterized the Industrial Revolution and led the common law to be largely displaced for workplace accidents by workers' compensation systems, we can contrast that with the efforts by jurists to deal with the growth of mass market consumer product markets and to adapt the privity rule to enable notions of right and responsibility to follow the commodity chain as those developments were happening. In both of those cases, we have a system that is open to the airing of grievances and new forms of social harm that weren't being addressed. We have two very different ways in which the common law responded. And we're not really normatively committed to either one of those responses. What we're committed to is the idea that this locus for airing grievances is a distinctive one. And we actually think, I think at least, I won't speak for Ben, but I think the states, along with Professor Farber, I think the states can easily show special injury under conventional public nuisance understandings. And I think that's significant because it allows us in a certain way to think about the greenhouse gas problem at a level that's scaled up and more commensurate with the magnitude of the problem, rather than thinking about 7 billion individual emitters who are both simultaneously polluters and victims, or soon to be victims. Rather than thinking in those terms, we can think of collective aggregated entities like states and the personality of California that's expressed via its distinctive greenhouse gas policy is significant. It's significant not only domestically, but also internationally as well. So the fact that we're committed to the plaintiffs being able to lose on the merits as opposed to through justiciability doctrines or other kind of preliminary threshold ways of dismissing their suits is, we think, significant. It would be significant if a court were forced to ask the question, is there a duty of reasonable care vis-a-vis greenhouse gas emissions? Because it would be a place in which the moral primitives of the situation are directly addressed, are forced to be addressed, and would bear an official imprimatur in a way that other policy arenas don't necessarily force that. On Professor Farber's points about the superiority and the necessity of the administrative state, I don't think we disagree with that at all. I will point out, though, that even a friendly presidential administration has been very adept at delaying the obvious legal implications of Mass v. EPA. And it might have been effective to have not only EPA pointing a bullet at Congress's head to do something serious about climate change, but also to have the courts able to point the federal common nuisance law bullet at the agency's head to get them to quicken the pace of implementing the statute.
I have a couple of comments about this. I'm not a fan of these state particular actions because I do think the slippage problems are very serious. The movement of injuries from industry from one state to another state is an invasion for this device or moving overseas. My guess is it will prove to be counterproductive. On the question of the tort law, it is clearly, I think, the case that all classical liberal tort systems were regulatory as well as compensatory and were understood to be such. The great advantage of the private right of action in the traditional discrete industry is that a single action will cover both. But the moment you start having diffuse harms, it may well be that you have to regulate the defendant and compensate the plaintiff by some other means through first-party insurance or self-insurance or something like that. As to workman's compensation, the history is not what Doug has said it to be. All original workman's compensation plans were done by private contract, starting in England in around the 1870s and 1880s, precisely because they weren't the only people, that is, the scholars, to recognize the inefficiency of the common law. It was recognized by many firms. If you wanted, I could give you a long discussion as to which firms go in and which firms start to take out. But this was a case in which the common law framework worked until it was wrecked by legislation, which prohibited the voluntary arrangements from taking place, which started in England with the 1897 Compensation Act, and then with the major American statutes in 1910, 1912, you had similar kinds of problems. So there's nothing wrong with the common law if you know how to use it. There's a lot wrong with it if you get the wrong state legislatures trying to figure out the way in which you're going to try to overhand it. Same thing is true with respect to product liability. It is interesting that the earlier guys who really weren't very good at sort of formal theory of economics actually produced much more efficient chain of control situations with respect to the tort law in 1903 than they were able to do by the time you got to the modern system in 1968. Because there you do need private rights of action with discrete harms, but the key feature is to organize the system around the presumption that the party in possession is most likely to be the party who causes the mischief, which means that you start downstream rather than upstream, and essentially what the law did was to reverse that situation so as to require you to try to regulate downstream contract by pushing on a chain with no particular kind of effectiveness. So I'm going to make again the same kind of point, and I'll end on this note. It is a mistake, I think, to start the discussion the way they did, which is, you know, we talk about immigration here, and we talk about global warming there, and we talk about prison guards in the other place. Unless you know the internal dynamics of the particular system that you're going to regulate, you're never going to come up with the right solution with respect to what is done. Understand the problem, then you could figure out how you allocate the responsibility. And what you're trying to do, in effect, is to get a set of discrete and clear rules. So instead of having all this huge level of discretion that requires plods and pleas, you'll get something that looks a little bit more rule-light and a little bit more coherent in terms of its economic objectives.
Yeah, just one very brief comment, which is that I agree that the court should not have held that the case failed because the federal common law of nuisance is displaced by federal statute. It's a little bit complicated, but my view is that the displacement doctrine, at least in the area of pollution law, has simply led to a mess because of the difficulty of reconciling the policies the court is trying to pursue with the displacement doctrine and the very strong savings clauses that the statutes contain. And so what they've ended up with is a sort of screwy doctrine that doesn't really advance any very intelligible purposes. So another area of agreement.